This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, written and read by James Fallows and Deborah Fallows. This is Deborah Fallows.
For our next generation, Jack, Tide, Eleanor, Navy, this is your country. Author's note. This book is a story of journeys that took place over more than 4 years, from preliminary and planning trips late in 2012 through our final cross-country travel at the start of 2017. Our goal has been to portray the people we spoke with and the places we visited at specific moments in time. Time has not stood still in any of these cities, and inevitably circumstances have changed from what we originally saw. Some people we interviewed have changed jobs, retired, gained or lost political office, moved to different parts of the country. At least one of them has died. Many of the businesses we describe have grown and prospered. At least two of them have failed. Cities and their populations have gone through political and cultural changes, some for the better, but not all. In a few important cases, we have noted these changes, but for the most part, we have left our account faithful to what we saw and heard when we were on scene. This account draws on extensive notes we made each night while on the road, a practice based on the belief that we'd remember and capture impressions more vividly during the same day than ever afterwards. It also draws on reports we posted along the way on the Atlantic's website and on later follow-up interviews. Reflecting this mix of reporting over an extended period, some of the narrative is left in present tense, describing what we saw at the time, for instance, the downtown is recovering. Other parts are in past tense, for instance, the mayor told us. For most of the cities we describe here, we made two or even three reporting visits, initially to get our bearings and then to follow leads or observe specific events. Usually those trips were only a few weeks apart. A few were separated by months. For clarity, we've combined the results of these separate trips in our accounts of each town. In one case, we discussed findings of a later journey to Louisville in 2016 in a sequence of earlier reports because of the thematic connections. Alternating sections of the book are written by me, James Fallows, and by Deborah Fallows. We'll each read what we wrote. Redlands, California, 2018.
Introduction, 2017, A Last Trip West. Montgomery County Traffic, Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, taking runway 14, VFR departure to the west, Montgomery. And with that, we were off, flying away from frigid Washington, D.C. and its political post-election turmoil, on a southerly route to California. We had flown nearly 100,000 miles in nearly 4 years in our small plane, with Jim as pilot and me in the right seat. We began in my home territory of the upper Midwest, then headed over to Maine and flew south through New England and the mid-Atlantic states to Georgia and Florida. We swept farther through the deep south to Texas and the southwest, up the Central Valley of California to Oregon and Washington, and closed the loop after leaving Montana. All the while, we snaked in and out of the so-called flyover country, through Wyoming, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and much more. We've landed in dozens of towns and cities along the way, anticipating in each of them the local stories that would organize themselves into some kind of composed narrative about the backbone and character of the region, and maybe beyond that, to help explain the character of the country. We began by looking for towns with positive energy, with signs of rebound from some kind of shock or shift, like a mine or factory that had closed, or waves of people who'd departed, or newcomers who'd arrived. We ended up adding towns with down-and-out reputations where we truly feared for what we might find. Life upon landing was never quite what we'd planned. We have stayed in towns for weeks at a time. We've often revisited them, following threads from one person or one group or town institution or movement to the next, settling into the local rhythm. We've gone to town plays and musicals, sat in on civic meetings, hung out at coffee shops and brew pubs, spent days at schools, libraries, and ballgames, taken tours of downtowns, visited factories, startups, and community college classes, taken boat rides and bike rides, swum in local public pools and run on high school tracks, borrowed cars and stayed in motels, private homes, and one-off eco-hotels. We remained long enough to begin to imagine how much we didn't know, but also to appreciate the unusual opportunity we've had in seeing a broader sampling of modern America's realities than most of its citizens will ever have a chance to do. This time we were heading to Jim's hometown of Redlands, in the orange-growing country of Southern California, to write this book. Our final flight west would mark both a leave-taking from frenetic Washington, D.C., and a homecoming. After so many miles, we knew that flight in a small plane is rarely routine. There are dramas when you're airborne. Weather, birds, parachute jumpers, mechanical blips, crop dusters and drones. And perspectives unfold among the clouds or over the sights below. Rangy forests, tamed farmlands, strings of quarries, hours of desert, well-defined prisons and pop-up small towns. Our departure was not auspicious. Cold, wind, snow, and icy conditions in Washington gave us a few more days to organize at home and winnow the next 6 months' belongings into the 140 extra pounds the plane could carry, besides us and a lot of fuel. Clothes, flight gear, electronics, emergency supplies, water, books, a little food. By now, I knew travels with Charlie the way some people know the Bible. And I was more than a little envious that Steinbeck could stock his trusty outfitted truck Rocinante without limit, including what he described as far too many clothes and a week's worth of food, plus liquor. Steinbeck could pack quadruple what he needed until Rocinante's springs overloaded, but if we did so, we would never get off the runway. Tuesday was still a blustery 29 degrees outside, but the clouds were high enough that we could fly below them without worry about ice forming from their moisture collecting on our wings. We bundled into clothing layers so thick that I had to loosen my seatbelt, a complex system of straps not unlike those in toddlers' car seats. I stretched my headset to fit over a heavy knit cap. Jim unplugged the plane's engine from its overnight warming station. After all that, the sound of the motor turning over quickly, and, I would add proudly, was our signal. The air traffic controllers, ATCs, my heroes of the sky, guided us through the busy Dulles airspace on a shortcut south. We were ready for headwinds, but not the strong 40 to 50 knots straight at us that slowed our ground speed from the accustomed 170 knots, about 200 miles per hour, down to as low as a measly 109. I was grateful for my natural sea legs, dating back to a childhood pounding over waves in small sailboats, which translated well to the bumps from gusty winds aloft. In autumn, if we flew north, we would watch the green leaves near the Mason-Dixon line fade to yellow, then pivot to a bright orange and red, until the foliage all but disappeared over northern New England. On this trip, the snowpack over Virginia melted thinner into the Carolinas, then gave way to dry land just south of Greenville. Clipped diction from the ATCs along the busy eastern seaboard slowed to a more languid drawl, and outside the temperature began inching up. We flew over Georgia's catfish farms and the erratic geometry of forest clearing, chasing the late afternoon sunset into Demopolis, Alabama, our destination. Jim had spent a good part of the summer of 1968 around Selma, Montgomery, and Demopolis as a teenage cub reporter for a civil rights newspaper called the Southern Courier. We wanted to give the town at least a quick look. Morning in Demopolis was downright balmy. In the Best Western breakfast room, Miss Nettie was making grits and biscuits for us and the out-of-town crews who had come in to monitor the planned outage at the cement factory. Two small things stood between us and our progress west. One was a problem with our onboard weather system. The software wasn't communicating to bring in the weather updates. Before this technology existed, we'd flown without radar depictions of the weather, but once you've had new tools, It's hard to go back, especially with some iffy weather forecast for the next few days along our route. The closest place to arrange for that repair was Dallas. But conditions by the time we could get there, forecast crosswinds, gusting above 30 and even 40 knots, far beyond safe landing guidelines for us. We settled in for an extra unexpected day in Demopolis, as we had in other places like Red Oak, Iowa, and Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Hickory, North Carolina. Luckily, and we have found there's usually good luck to match the bad, we had ended up the night before at a cozy Demopolis bistro and found ourselves in conversation with owner Mike Grayson, who turned out to have been the mayor of Demopolis for the previous 8 years. He was full of suggestions for what to see and do there. Our first stop was the Demopolis Public Library, my favorite institution. Inside public libraries, we had learned from visiting them in nearly every town on our journey, you see the people, programs, problems, and answers that offer a genuine look into the heart and soul of a town. This public library, housed in a former furniture company store and warehouse, is as elegant and graceful as any Carnegie library I've seen. A wraparound balcony on the second-story mezzanine overlooks the main reading room with its wooden mission-style work tables and lamps. Oversized photos of some of the town's historic moments lined the walls. One showed Woodrow Wilson, who'd visited nearly a century ago for the then-legal cockfighting at a fundraising auction to build a bridge over the Tombigbee River. More recently, Bill and Melinda Gates visited in 1998 to check out one of the first computer donations made by their Gates Library Foundation. Connie Lawson, who worked at the library then and still does now, recalled the visit as if it were yesterday. They had spent days cleaning the building down to the baseboards, nervous about making a good impression. Lawson said that the Gateses were as nice as could be. She didn't wear a touch of makeup, and he held his tie in place against the wind with a piece of tape. The world's richest man had no tie clip, Lawson marveled nearly 20 years later. After a second morning's grits and biscuits from Miss Nettie, we headed for Dallas, passing over Meridian and Jackson, south of the startlingly booming new heavy manufacturing center of Mississippi's Golden Triangle. This was territory familiar to us from at least three earlier reporting trips, where we'd seen a helicopter factory, a drone plant, a sophisticated state-of-the-art steel mill, the groundbreaking for a Yokohama tire plant, and East Mississippi Community College, which was training former textile workers for the new skilled jobs arriving in the area. I always looked forward to crossing the Mississippi River. We've done that from just about every state through which the mighty river flows, especially in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois. There it would be today as we left the state of Mississippi, below us just around Vicksburg. I was worried about even getting a glimpse because of the low clouds. We watched the navigation maps on the cockpit monitors, and just as we approached the river, the clouds parted. Jim banked the plane to dip the wing for a good view from my right side seat. I stole enough of a look to recognize the powerful Mississippi. The following day, a cool drizzle moved in over Dallas as we were preparing to depart, reminding us why we'd avoided winter during most of our flying in the last 3 years. We filed an instrument plan, and for the next 3 hours, we were either in the thick cloud layer or just above it, barely seeing the vast stretches of West Texas below us or the sun above. I think Jim enjoys the challenge of this kind of flying. He's always on the instruments, pushing buttons, checking gauges, switching screens, and testing the redundant system. The total focus of piloting spirits him away from every single earthly concern. For me, the opaque flying is unpleasant. I find it a little spooky and am unnerved by the absence of orientation to the ground. I'm not a pilot, which is often an uncomfortable admission. I don't share the zealous passion for flying that I have seen in most pilots, and my eyesight has always been, well, wanting. If Jim says, "Do you see the runway?" I'll mumble something in return. But after 1,000 hours of being in the right seat, I know a lot about flying the plane. I know its repertoire of gurgles and agitations as well as I knew those of our infant children. I'm very familiar with the gauges, navigation, radio work with the ATC, steering the plane, and I know how to pull the parachute, which deploys from the fuselage and settles the plane in a true emergency. The parachute of the Cirrus, now the best-selling small aircraft in the world, eliminates night-before-flight worries for me. For distraction on days of long flights, there is always the radio. The air traffic controllers were busy over West Texas with its vast stretches of military airspace. There were many calls between the ATCs and Fighter 25 and Fighter 26, who were no doubt on training missions. I tallied at least 5 medevac flights in the air that day, which seemed like a lot until I considered the long, desolate stretches of road between sick or injured people and medical attention. Pilots this day requested vectoring to get to places with names that sounded exotic and evocative. Amarillo, San Angelo, Dalhart, Alpine, El Paso. When the ATC chatter faded out, we switched to Sirius XM radio and toggled around. Road dog trucking warned about winter road conditions and impending ice storms over Omaha and St. Louis. In one of my favorite segments on road dog trucking, called Worst Load Ever, drivers would call in with stories and try to outdo one another. One trucker was driving north to Saskatchewan through burning country with flames along both sides of the highway. "We were on fire," he said, "with 2,800 gallons of aircraft fuel aboard. Helicopters were dropping water bombs alongside him. It was kind of hot," he continued undramatically. "A bad load trip through kind of a shitty time. Ain't too many people who could say, 'I hauled a load of jet fuel through a forest fire. What have you done?'" Background music by the band faded in. "I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead." Rural radio offered up local crop prices and advice on pest control. Entire stations were dedicated to Willie Nelson or Bruce Springsteen, or coffeehouse music or jazz, or the irreverent guys on the Catholic Channel. We ascended to 10,000 feet to cross the southernmost remnants of the Rockies, the Guadalupe Mountains, on our way to Las Cruces. This reminded me of the tail end of a stretch of the Great Wall of China in Gansu Province. We'd climbed a section near where the crumbling remains had become little more than an obstacle for farmers to work around in their fields. Finally, the cloud cover was dissipating. Our little cabin, about the size of a sedan, isn't pressurized. Legally, you can fly without oxygen up to 14,000 feet. We carry small bottles of oxygen on board for emergency. Technical note: after 30 minutes at 12,500 feet, the pilot is required to use oxygen. Even at 10,000 feet, I felt myself involuntarily taking longer, deeper breaths, and I also started checking the color of my fingernail beds for any tinge of blue, which signals oxygen deprivation. We were fine, of course. We stopped in Las Cruces in search of cheap fuel and a late afternoon lunch. We never knew what kind of food we'd find. Many times, vending machine peanut butter crackers were the best we could do. I worried about this a lot in our early days. Our go-to provisions were a cool sack with dried fruit, nuts, granola bars, carrots, hummus, grapes, cheese, vitamin water, you get the picture. Over time, the list became leaner and leaner. By now, more than 3 years later, we'd actually become aficionados of jerky, beef, buffalo, reindeer, elk, spicy lime ginger teriyaki. One Uber driver who drove us on an unscheduled stop in Wyoming went on for 20 minutes with stories about his homemade jerky from a personal drying machine. When lunch in Las Cruces didn't work out, jerky it was. We pressed on for another hour or so to Tucson. The mountains deflated into undulating brown hills. We flew over flatlands with occasional volcanic outcroppings and long stretches of almost surreal desert landscapes that look like pointillist paintings. In Tucson were some threads we had left unraveled over Arizona. I wanted to trace a few more steps taken by Isabella Greenway, one of the extraordinary women I had stumbled onto. She was a lifelong friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, twice a widow to two of Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, a builder and shaper who brought the beautiful copper mining town of Ajo, Arizona, to its heyday. She was Arizona's first female representative in Congress as part of FDR's New Deal Democratic majority. And she also built and opened Tucson's Arizona Inn, which was, I had heard, still thriving today under the family eye. So a visit to the Arizona Inn was very special, and a splurge for us, and it turned out to be exactly what I had imagined. Isabella Greenway herself described it as a simple, home-like cottage hotel, but it is much more than that, with high-ceilinged, oversized rooms, furniture from its own shop, quiet green spaces, a big pool, almost 20 meters by my stroke count, wonderful food, and a hospitality still imbued with the family's sensibility. On a whim, I emailed the current proprietor, Patty Dorr, the granddaughter of Isabella Greenway. To my surprise, she emailed right back. The next morning, we met with her and her son and co-proprietor, the writer Will Conroy, to swap photos and stories about the different pieces of Isabella's life that we each knew. We left Tucson reluctantly but with strong tailwinds, the first of this cross-continental trip. We hadn't really been expecting tailwinds since we were flying into the prevailing westerly winds, so this was indeed special and appreciated. Just north of Gila Bend, Jim and I were chatting about our first trip here a few years back on our way to Ajo, a tiny oasis of a town in the Sonoran Desert. The ATC interrupted our reminiscing to say he could no longer see us on his radar. This wasn't so surprising. It often happened with a relatively low-altitude flight, or in remote areas far from controllers, or with natural impediments like mountains that block the radar beams. Jim recycled the transponder, a click of one button that often cleared up the connections. This time, nothing. Then the dials and gauges on the cockpit monitors, showing ground speed, wind directions, location, just about everything, began to go haywire. They spun around randomly, showing a 150-knot headwind, then a tailwind, then no wind. I thought of The Exorcist. The moving map, with our location, waypoints, obstacles like mountains, restricted airspace and other airplanes, suddenly blanked out, as if it had no idea where a plane actually was. Red warning signs popped up on the dual GPS guidance system. Almost everything in the plane's critical instrumentation has a backup, indicating lost signals. Then the urgent robo-voice was yelling, "Terrain! Terrain!" We looked around instinctively, confirming a flat desert floor, but no high terrain of any sort. All this was getting Jim's attention. He switched to his pre-GPS, old-school backup navigation systems. It was dark comfort to hear a call from United 404, reporting to the ATC that they had also lost their GPS. At least it wasn't just our plane. I studied the dials, thinking overdramatically that this was how the world as we knew it might look during some kind of nefarious global technological takeover. The ATC said calmly, controllers are always calm, that there must be a military test exercise of GPS jamming happening today. Later, on the ground, Jim learned that the Air Force was indeed running a month-long trial in that area, testing the effects of intentional GPS outages. Thanks for letting us know, I thought. As we flew over Palm Springs, the aerial road signs were becoming familiar. The mountains north and south, the desert settlements below, the wind farms, the Banning Pass through to the Los Angeles Basin. We had been here several times before. We flew over Redlands, our destination, to San Bernardino and the long, wide runways that had once accommodated B-52s when this site was Norton Air Force Base. Jim guided our Cirrus in, hovering near touchdown in the wind gusts for the final few hundred feet. Landed. What were we supposed to feel now, some 2,500 miles and 4 days later, or 100,000 miles and 4 years later? Maybe like Mark Twain, I thought, one of the writers whose account of an epic journey I had read. At the end of 20 days by stagecoach, the Washoe Zephyr, from Missouri to the territory of Nevada, Twain wrote, "It had been a fine pleasure trip. We had fed fat on wonders every day. We were now well accustomed to stage life and very fond of it. So the idea of coming to a standstill in a village was not agreeable, but on the contrary depressing. We too had indeed fed fat on wonders every day. Our ending didn't feel as sad as Twain described his, but he was young then and didn't understand yet that you can craft many adventures in a lifetime. I knew we would head on to many more adventures, and that this ending was, again, another beginning."
We began this project with one purpose in mind. We wanted to take a fresh look at the country, its disappointments and its possibilities. We ended up wondering about questions and trends that were different from what we'd expected, and with a story to tell that we could barely have imagined when we were starting out. By the end of the journey, we felt sure of something we had suspected at the beginning, that an important part of the face of modern America has slipped from people's view, in a way that makes a big and a destructive difference in the country's public and economic life. Despite the economic crises of the preceding decade and the social tensions of which every American is aware, most parts of the United States that we visited have been doing better in most ways than most Americans realize. Because many people don't know that, they're inclined to view any local problems as symptoms of wider disasters, and to dismiss local successes as fortunate anomalies. Thus, they feel even angrier about the country's challenges than they should, and more fatalistic about the prospects of dealing with them. We wanted to look at parts of the country generally missed by the media spotlight. That would mean reporting in the places often considered as flyover country. Such cities, medium-sized or below, and rural areas, usually make their way to national attention only after a tornado or a mass shooting, during presidential campaign season, or as backdrops for concept pieces like the private prison revolution or After Coal, What? We were interested in places that had faced adversity of some sort, from crop failure to job loss to political crisis, and had looked for ways to respond. Since the late 1990s, we had flown at low altitude in little single-engine, four-seat propeller airplanes, seeing the sorts of landscapes, communities, and cultures that can be hard to reach otherwise. Once we had stopped unexpectedly in Red Oak, Iowa, a tiny farming center usually neglected even during the saturation coverage every 4 years of the Iowa caucuses. There we learned about an enclave of Central American immigrants who had set up successful operations in what would be considered a classically insular, non-diverse part of America. When we touched down at the small airport on the evening of our arrival, taking our place in the landing sequence among the crop dusters that were buzzing in and out to fertilize or apply insecticide to the surrounding corn and soybean fields, we saw a group of junior high school-aged boys plus one girl gathered in the small airport building. They were clustered around a grizzled-looking flight instructor who was teaching them about aerial navigation as part of the weekly meeting of local cadets in the Civil Air Patrol. We stayed for a while and talked with students and instructors, learned about some other efforts underway to add life and attract residents to what had been a declining small town, and left the next day with an impression we frequently found ourselves with, that of an intensity of local civic life that generally escaped any outside notice. It was the kind of activity that readers take for granted in Tocqueville-era accounts of the American genius for association, or in Frank Capra-era depictions of the most appealing sides of mid-20th century American life, but also the type assumed to have vanished in this era of social media silos. Wherever we stopped, we saw things of this sort. On a trip through the Mountain West, bad weather forced us to make an overnight stay in the rough mining town of Rock Springs, Wyoming. It had been famous in the 19th century for a race riot in which white mine workers beat and shot and burned the houses of Chinese immigrants who had come to the western United States to build the Transcontinental Railroad, but then stayed to work in the mines. Mainly white miners killed at least 28 Chinese workers during that riot in 1885. When we visited more than 125 years later, Rock Springs was booming again as the world's main source of a mineral called trona, which, when converted to soda ash, is a necessary component for countless industrial processes around the world. Glass, detergents, baking soda, kitty litter, and many other products all depend on trona mined in Rock Springs. We saw Rock Springs' modern Chinese community, its African-American miners, and others improbably attracted to a city we had come upon by happenstance. We had a similar sense, wait, there's more here than we imagined, after stops in Scott's Bluff and in Grand Island, Nebraska, and Richmond, Indiana, and Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Astoria, Oregon, and Yakima, Washington. In late 2012, we began planning a journey. We knew we were looking for medium-sized or smaller towns. The definition was flexible. We ended up visiting places as sizable as Columbus, Ohio, the 15th largest city in the country, though most were much smaller, like Eastport, Maine, population less than 1,500. Early in 2013, I put an item on the Atlantic's website asking for suggestions from readers on why it would be worth learning the story of their town. More than 1,000 entries arrived, at least 700 of them extended essays, and we began compiling a list. In June, we began our travels. Early on was a week-long stop in the little lakeside town of Holland, Michigan, a longtime manufacturing center that had managed to avoid the general fate of Rust Belt decline, and a city that had also coped with what we have come to see as a much broader pattern of ethnic change. Before our time in Holland and on a return trip afterward, we went to Sioux Falls and Rapid City in South Dakota, which had their own economic, cultural, and political surprises. We spent several months working our way up and down the West Coast, from the tiny town of Ajo, Arizona, built next to what was once one of North America's largest copper mines, to the troubled, now famous California city of San Bernardino, and northward to Fresno in California's Central Valley, Bend and its neighboring cities in Central Oregon, and the twin cities of Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkston, Washington. On the East Coast, we've been as far north as Eastport, the very last city on Maine's down east coast before the Bay of Fundy in Canada, and as far south as St. Mary's, Georgia, which is east of the Okefenokee Swamp and just north of the Florida border. By the end, we'd made extended visits, usually totaling 2 weeks, in each of 25 cities across the country, with shorter visits to another 24. There are dozens more we would like already to have visited, and that we plan to spend time in and learn about in the next wave of our travels. These are places like Rochester and Buffalo, New York, Chattanooga and Knoxville, Tennessee, Dayton and Youngstown, Ohio, South Bend and Gary, Indiana, the Batavia area and Moline in Illinois, Stockton and Fremont, California, Brownsville, Texas, Lakeland and St. Petersburg, Florida, Danville in Kentucky, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Greater St. Louis in Missouri, in Virginia, Roanoke and Hampton Roads, Frederick, Maryland, Lewiston in Maine, Huntsville and Mobile in Alabama, Reno, Nevada, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and many more. With each new city we've spent time in and learned about, the list of places we'd like to go next continues to grow. This is an ongoing project. We ask readers to send a tweet about their cities to @JamesFallows or @FallowsDeb with the hashtag ThisIsMyTown, or a longer message about where you live and why to thestoryofmytown@gmail.com. There is a high-toned tradition of road trips as a means of discovering America, from Lewis and Clark and Tocqueville through John Dos Passos, or John Steinbeck, and William Least Heat Moon. Apart from other obvious points of contrast, our project is different in that rather than going by car or by wagon or pirogue, we've gone from city to city in our family's small, single-engine propeller plane, a Cirrus SR-22. This was a decision made for convenience, for beauty, and for edification. The convenience comes from the simple fact that almost any settlement in America is within close range of a place where a small airplane can land. some 5,000 public landing facilities, many of them built for military purposes during and after World War II, are scattered about the United States, making many remote hamlets much more easily reachable by air than by other means. The beauty comes from the unending fascination of watching the American landscape unfurl below you as you travel at low altitude. At the dawn of powered flight, a century ago, it was assumed that writers and painters would want to become aviators, and vice versa. Charles Lindbergh, Amelia Earhart, and Ernest K. Gann were flyers who wrote. Beryl Markham, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, and Anne Morrow Lindbergh were writers who flew, because of the unique perspective on civilization and nature offered by the aerial view. The late novelist James Salter, who was a Korean War fighter pilot and retained his passion for flight, was a mid-century example. William Langewisch, a longtime book and magazine writer, and the son of Wolfgang Langewisch, whose Stick and Rudder is the flying world's equivalent of The Elements of Style, is a recent example. Mark von Honecker, a 747 pilot who writes about flight with extraordinary elegance in his book Skyfaring, is another. From ground level, America is mainly road. After all, that's where cars can take you. From the sky, America is mainly forest in the eastern third, farmland in the middle, and then mountain and desert in the west, before the strip of intense development along the California coast. It's also full of features obvious from the sky that are much harder to notice from the ground and are difficult to pick out from 6 miles up in an airliner. Some of the most striking are quarries at the edges of most towns to provide gravel for roads and construction sites, or prisons, instantly identifiable by their fencing, though some mega high schools can look similar, and usually miles from the nearest town or tucked into locations where normal traffic won't pass by, and the vast sea of parking lot spaces surrounding shopping malls on the edges of towns. We never tire of the view from this height, as different from the normal, grim airliner perspective as scuba diving is from traveling on a container ship. The edification comes from lessons in history, geography, urban planning, and environmental protection and despoliation that are inescapably obvious from above. Why is St. Louis where it is? Ah, of course, it's where the Missouri and Mississippi rivers come together. Why were mill towns built along the fall line of the Appalachians? Because of the long north-south series of waterfalls to power them. As you cross South Dakota from east to west, from the big city of Sioux Falls at the Iowa and Minnesota borders, towards Rapid City and the Black Hills and beyond, you can see the terrain change sharply. In the East River portion of the state, between Sioux Falls and the Missouri, you see flat, well-watered farmlands and small farming towns. Then, past Pierre, you reach West River, with rough, dry badlands, some grazing cattle, and very few structures. Everyone who has looked at a map knows about the effects of topography and rainfall, but it means something different as it unfolds below you like a real-world Google Earth. You can also see the history of transportation in the way towns are settled. Even in South Dakota's fertile East River area, you can easily trace from low altitude what the railroads ushered in 150 years ago and how their impact has ebbed. As we flew along one of the east-west lines that brought settlers into these territories and carried crops out to markets, we would see little settlements every few minutes. In the 1800s, these were set up at roughly 10-mile intervals, an efficient distance when farmers were delivering their harvests by wagon. Now it seems that 4 out of 5 of these little towns are withering, as farms are run with giant combines and crops are hauled by truck. With each city we visited and stop we made, the list of future places we hoped to learn about only grew. But as the months and years went on, we developed a picture of on-the-ground realities different from what we had assumed when the journey began. 2013. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We arrived in Sioux Falls on our wedding anniversary. That evening, we headed from our motel to the nearby Granite City Brewery. It was an introduction to the reality that we would be able to find brew pubs almost every place we went. Granite City started in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and was at that time spreading across the Plain States. Our anniversary on the summer solstice in June is the longest day of the year. In the long, late night of the Northern Plains on June 21st, we watched the sun spread a slanting light over the city's bike path and talked with a group of young women who were out in the town on some sort of celebration. It turned out that they were all nursing students and all from smaller cities across the plains. Did they like Sioux Falls, we asked? Oh, yes, they began telling us in detail. It was growing. It was friendly. Proving their point, they bought us beers when they learned it was our anniversary. It was big enough to have everything, especially with a growing medical community, and small enough to be approachable and easy. It's a big, small town, one of them said. The first but not the last time we heard that. The excitement of the young nurses about the opportunities in the city and their emphasis on the just rightness of Sioux Falls turned out to be no accident. The profound impact of the local circumstances, the farm economy, its position as capital of this part of the prairie, its central location within the continent, were ingredients in the economic strategy that made Sioux Falls work. Every city that is trendy or successful in some way attracts people from someplace else. The biggest, hottest international magnet cities, Los Angeles or San Francisco, New York or Washington, D.C., Boston or Chicago or Miami or Seattle, or whatever you'd add to that list, draw people from around the country and the world. If someone from South Dakota shows up at a research lab in Boston, or a tech team in the Bay Area, or on a TV show in Los Angeles, the standard coastal narrative would be that the person had made it out of the heartland and into the big time. The dominant tone we heard in Sioux Falls was of people who feel that they have made it precisely by getting to the state's biggest city, from the farms or the tiny hamlets where they grew up. The big box malls all around Sioux Falls are a disappointingly familiar part of its look, versus the more homegrown look of its restored and revived downtown. But those malls also symbolize the city's role in the region, which in turn gives so many people there a sense of being in the right place at the right time, of having come to a place rather than just having left wherever they were from. Many people we met, like the nurses that first night, talked about Sioux Falls as occupying a sweet spot, big enough to offer most of what was attractive about very large cities, the shopping, the medical care, the entertainment, and an increasingly rich food and drink life, but small enough to be manageable, inexpensive, and something we often heard, safe. Our first impression of Sioux Falls was dominated by three great features. One was the falls themselves on the Big Sioux River. They are in the center of town, and a dozen years ago, they had been crime-ridden and graffiti-covered. As part of a civic cleanup program, they have been surrounded by a polished-seeming Falls Park, an attraction for tourists and a destination for local families. The park's improvement came in parallel with a similar, larger civic effort, the 20-mile bike and walking course that circles the entire town. We didn't realize it at the time, but the falls and the trails are markers for something we'd encounter almost every place we went. Restoration or revival of civic attractions like the falls and creation of bike and walking paths. Deb eventually formulated a law. The mark of a successful city is having a river walk, whether or not there is a river. The second prominent feature, dominating a hill overlooking the falls and the adjoining part of the bike path, is the state penitentiary. We learned that it was the subject of a hoary local joke. Back in the 1880s, when the Dakota Territory was preparing to become two states, the prospective South Dakota state government offered what was then, and still is, its largest city, Sioux Falls, a choice. Would it prefer to be the home of the state university or of the state pen? The joke was that the penitentiary offered steadier work for the locals, so that is what they chose. The University of South Dakota wound up in the much smaller town of Vermilion, but Sioux Falls now has an assortment of public and private universities. The third major feature, the most evocative of all, is the giant downtown abattoir, generally known as John Morrell's. where thousands of pigs go to their deaths every day. In many parts of the United States, you might complain that it's hard to see the economy anymore. There are too many indistinguishable office blocks, too few old economy structures where real work is done. In downtown Sioux Falls, where the slaughterhouse is an unavoidable visual and aromatic reminder of the realities of the modern food chain, and where it has a distinct social significance as well, you would never say that. In the century plus since John Morrell opened the slaughterhouse in 1909, it has been an arena for wave after wave of ethnic and economic change in this part of America. Eastern Europeans and Germans worked for Morrell during the pre-World War I era of mass immigration. As a high-wage, unionized employer for half a century after that war, despite the physical and psychological hardships of the job, Morrell was part of the road to the middle class for people in the area. People we met at the newspaper, or the universities, in the city governments, or in the banks had family stories that began with versions of, "We came to town when my dad got a job with Morrell's." By the 1980s, it was a center of bitter labor strife, which led to a strike and the breaking of the union. Now it symbolizes two aspects of the global connections of even the most removed-seeming parts of the American topography. One is its workforce, which has become part of the area's refugee fabric. From Somalia, from Sudan, from the Congo, from Burma, from Nepal, the latest rounds of immigrants are working in this plant. The other connection is in its ownership. In the 1990s, the Morrell Company sold to Smithfield, which in turn was sold in 2013 to the Chinese firm Shanghui. As we'd known from our previous years of living in China, Shanghui and other high-end food companies there were in a desperate race to demonstrate to customers that they offered safer, less adulterated products, ones that met international standards. Thus, from this slaughterhouse in the center of town, in this corner of Plain States America, you had a little parable for globalized connections, regardless of changing political sentiments. Every morning, pigs that have spent all but the final days of their lives in Iowa, which has more permissive legislation on large-scale pig rearing, cross the Big Sioux River into South Dakota and proceed towards their fate. In the slaughterhouse, workers, mainly refugees who've come from every corner of the world, put the pigs to death and convert them into meat. And then a Chinese company, relying on the United States' reputation for higher food safety standards, ships much of the meat to customers who are rapidly moving up the protein chain in China. There was one other significant aspect of Sioux Falls' appearance, which took us a while to notice, but whose significance eventually became plain. That is the city's sprawl, taken for granted as part of the automobile-era American landscape, but with additional meaning for Sioux Falls and places like it. Some cities look smaller than they actually are. When living in Shanghai, we tried to make sense of statistics showing that our immediate walking and shopping neighborhood had a population of more than 1 million, or maybe two. Sioux Falls is the reverse. The official population is above or below 200,000, depending on how much of the surrounding area you take in, but the sprawl and physical extent is that of a much larger place. If the footprint of Sioux Falls were laid down anywhere in China, you'd expect a population at least 20 times as great. We later learned what reasons, apart from standard-issue sprawl, accounted for the city's footprint. An improbable part of the region's economic base is its role as a financial center. The next time you receive a credit card statement, check the address. Odds are that your payment is headed to Sioux Falls. That is the result of an effort by state leaders in the late 1970s, when they used the state's heart-of-the-country location as part of a winning argument that Citibank and other major credit card companies should move their processing centers there from high-cost locations in New York. At the time, Nevada, Delaware, and Missouri, and several other states, including South Dakota, were in a race to the bottom to relax their usury laws, so that financial companies headquartered there could charge whatever interest rates they wanted. But in itself, that wasn't enough to make Sioux Falls plausible as a next home for operations historically based on the East Coast. And that's where Benjamin Franklin and Wernher von Braun come in. As Robert E. Wright, an economics professor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, wrote in Wall Street on the Prairie, an online history of Citibank's decision. The Benjamin Franklin part of the decision involved the U.S. Postal Service, of which Franklin was the first Postmaster General. For reasons involving the great efficiency of Sioux Falls' transportation system and the congestion of its counterparts in the East, South Dakota officials argued that a payment mailed in from one of the five New York boroughs would reach Citibank more quickly if it had an address in South Dakota than if that same check were sent right to its headquarters in New York. As Wright put it, that sounds incredible and is almost certainly apocryphal marketing hype, but what matters is that Citibank officials believed that payments and other correspondence sent from most places in the country would reach Sioux Falls before they would hit New York's financial district. The Wernher von Braun part of the equation was shorthand for the Cold War-era space systems, military and civilian, that the United States deployed with help from scientists who had once worked for the Nazis, like von Braun. These included strategic bomber bases and ICBM sites in the Dakotas, which in turn meant an advanced telephone and eventually internet communication system that happened to link Sioux Falls with the outside world in a reliable and very high-speed way. In those days when long-distance calls were still expensive, either for the customers or for the company offering a 1-800 system to absorb the cost, it was cheaper, on average, for callers from around the country to phone into relatively central Sioux Falls than to call New York. Beyond that, the accent of Sioux Falls residents sounded normal rather than regional to callers from most other states. "People could understand us," Wright said when I met him in Augustana, "and on the phone we were nice. There's a culture of education and work here." The city willed itself into a role as a back-office financial center. By 1982, one-third of all the mail going through its very efficient post office was for Citibank. By the time we visited, a generation later, 10% of the local workforce held finance-related jobs, roughly twice the national average. Sioux Falls also created an advantage in the realm of high tech, with two facilities that in their fields are now world famous. One of them, Raven Industries, ended up here through a combination of effort and happenstance. During the all-out militarization of the U.S. economy during World War II, a time in which Henry Ford's car-making company became one of the world's largest producers of airplanes, General Mills of Minnesota, the same company best known now for breakfast cereals, also served as a military contractor. After the war, General Mills set up the Aeronautical Research Division, which specialized in high-altitude balloons. In those pre-satellite days, balloons were uniquely valuable for carrying sensors and surveillance cameras. By the mid-1950s, four General Mills engineers were ready to leave and start a balloon company of their own. For reasons ranging from airport congestion, airports in the Twin Cities were very crowded, Joe Foss Field in Sioux Falls was more welcoming, to prevailing wind patterns, they decided to start their new company in Sioux Falls. The company has now become dominant in a number of tech-intensive fields, all of them involving advanced balloons. First is Raven's Aerostat line. These are great big surveillance balloons used by the Customs Service, the U.S. military overseas, and similar customers. We went to a hangar at a Raven location in the middle of a cornfield 10 miles north of the city to see some of these huge devices. Another part of the balloon tech division makes the cartoon character balloons familiar from Macy's Thanksgiving Day parades in New York. In the summer of 2013, 5 months before that year's parade, Deb and I enjoyed the frisson of seeing the then-secret designs on the hangar floor. And the third high-tech balloon effort was providing the launch vehicles for Google's Project Loon, an ambitious plan of that era to provide very low-cost internet for everyone to underserved parts of the world via a network of high-altitude balloons. Raven was making the balloons, 60 feet tall, designed to fly at 66,000 feet, there in Sioux Falls and preparing them for launch. Raven has also been developing the agricultural version of self-driving cars. These involve GPS guidance systems for farming vehicles so tall, wide, and complex that the word tractor seems disrespectful. By whatever name, combine, behemoth, these have been part of a digitized revolution in farming. GPS guidance allows farmers to plow furrows longer and straighter than had ever before been possible, to apply fertilizer to the exact points where seeds have been sown, and in countless other ways to speed the age of precision agriculture. Not long after Raven's arrival, Sioux Falls also became the home site of an even more broadly significant aerial technology company. In the late 1960s, the Pentagon, NASA, and the CIA were looking for a safe, central location for the rapidly increasing flow of satellite imagery of the Earth. South Dakota Senator Carl Mundt worked with Sioux Falls officials to demonstrate that their area was ideally situated to receive data from satellites as they passed over the United States. In the early 1970s, they opened the Earth Resources Observation and Science Center, or EROS, in a cornfield just north of Sioux Falls. Now it is a repository of more digital images of the Earth, military, civilian, environmental, cartographic, than any other. Much of what you have seen on Google Earth originates from a master file at EROS, as did most of the graphics used in the International Climate Talks. Because of EROS, hundreds of scientists have come from around the world to work in Sioux Falls. We spent most of the day touring EROS, seeing its huge antennas through which satellites download their data, and their sequence of historic photos. These show, for instance, the loss of tree cover in the Amazon. Tom Holm, chief of the Policy and Communication Office at EROS, told us since the Brazilian government began using our photos, they've slowed the rate of deforestation. The photos also show urban growth in China. Holm said, "You can see how Beijing emptied out during the Cultural Revolution, and then the development since then." They also show the changing sizes of lakes and the robustness of wheat fields in the Great Plains states during wet and dry years. "I have the best possible combination," Holm told us. He had grown up near Sioux Falls, done his undergraduate work at South Dakota State nearby, and spent a summer as an intern at EROS, and then headed off for graduate school before returning. "I work in one of the most exciting places on Earth," he said, "and I am home." There's more in this town. There's a significant healthcare establishment, part of it funded by a local credit card entrepreneur made good named Denny Sanford. There are diverse community colleges and universities. There's a startup tech sector, and for most of the year since 2013, it's had the lowest unemployment rate in the country. The Sioux Falls area has its severe problems as well. We saw signs of the opioid crisis there. The state's numerous tribal reservations are mainly far to the west, but the chronic economic and health problems of many of their residents affect life statewide. Floods, drought, climate shift, and volatile world markets affect the farming industry, and on down the list. But while the outside world might easily have assumed these and a score of other challenges, how much was going on in this part of inland America would, we thought, come as a surprise.
We weren't surprised to find that Sioux Falls had become the move-to town for aspiring residents of many of South Dakota's rural towns. What we hadn't expected was the great number of people in another group, those who were instantly distinguishable from South Dakotans of German and Scandinavian heritage. These are the foreigners of so many different colors and ethnic groups. Beginning in the 1970s, Sioux Falls welcomed wave after wave of refugees. The city is well known in the refugee and migrant community for having a strong, supportive system. The population is large and diverse. Take the schools as a proxy. Nearly 10% of the students in Sioux Falls public schools are designated as ELL, English Language Learner, students. They are native speakers of some 60 different languages. 60! Can you even name 60 languages? When the Sioux Falls Public Schools opened their doors in 2013, The biggest single group of these students, about one-third of the total, according to school district figures, were the 700 Spanish speakers, many of whom arrived in migrant worker families. As for the other two-thirds, when we visited, there were 259 Nepali speakers, 135 who spoke Arabic, 129 Swahili, 101 Somali, 93 Amharic, 84